Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Today's episode is exceptional. And granted, part of my job as host is to use this part of the intro to hype it up and tell you why listening to this is worth your time. But in this case, I cannot overestimate the knowledge, the insights, the dynamism, the brilliance of the people participating in this podcast talking about a really contentious subject. Artificial intelligence, which is a catch-all. There's a whole bunch of technologies and tools fit under that spectrum. It's something people have a lot of anxiety about, a lot of curiosity, we hope, but also sometimes fear. So today we really tried to not only break down what AI is, how AI models are trained, what edge computing is, but the business case, the larger ecosystem, and the way in which agriculture is particularly poised to be a beneficiary of the AI revolution, especially the agentic revolution, i.e. the rise of agents. Now, if all of this is a kind of buzzword bingo for you, which as a regular listener, I would hope that it isn't, this nonetheless is an advanced class where we've taken the three top minds around AI and agriculture in Canada and have tasked them with coming together to answer not just the basic questions, but some of the more advanced. When it comes to literacy, when it comes to data governance, data sharing, and some of the challenges to sovereignty, not just around agriculture, but around the use of AI and society. So this is, I think, one of those episodes that demonstrates why the Future Herd exists as a cross-sectoral collaboration that brings together different actors, different voices, in a way that isn't happening anywhere else in society or maybe around the world. So again, I hope you enjoy it. Certainly, this is the kind of work that inspires me, and it really gets into the substance as to why we should be curious about AI rather than just close-minded. All right, let's enjoy the chat. Welcome, all of you, back to the Future Herd for what is on the technical level a panel episode, but in reality is an all-star episode as we've been able to gather some of the greatest, brightest minds in the agricultural sector, but also in the AI sector. And that's the three of you, the five of us, are a bunch of heavyweights when it comes to dealing with these particular issues. And of course, I much prefer in the age of Google, in the age of LLMs, to forego any introductions. Our listeners, as they listen, can do their due diligence and find out who you are. I really want to take the most of the time we have together and really try to get a sense of the advanced applications of the technology in the broader public context. And I say that because I personally feel torn every day that on the one hand, I am experiencing such incredible technology that is allowing my brain to go places I never thought possible. And yet I'm surrounded by a public that seems afraid, seems angry, seems opposed to the tools that I'm using. So I kind of wanted to start with a general question of, you know, I find the three of you individually and sectorally doing amazing work with amazing technology. How are you wrestling with the public debate, whether in the abstract or whether in your family, whether in your community, whether people are like, what are you doing with that AI stuff? How do you translate it in a way that cuts through the noise, cuts through the hype? And I'm saying this as an intro question because, unfortunately, I think even within agriculture, there are the skeptics, there are the doomers, there are the people who aren't really ready to open their mind to this stuff. And I think the three of you are exactly the right leaders to help make that happen. So, Mohammed, I'm going to throw to you, if only because I suspect that you have experienced what I'm describing, given the travels that you engage in. How do you frame this technology to the public? How do you counter some of the disinformation and some of the fear that is out there?
So first off, thanks for inviting me on to this all-star panel. I wouldn't say I'm an all-star myself, but no, of course, my two colleagues here definitely have a storied history within the sector. So great to be on with both of them. When it comes to the conversation about artificial intelligence and within the ag sector, I was joking to my wife last week that I feel like I have a house in Toronto, but I'm always outside across the country. So I've been able to see, like, on the ground what's happening and, you know, the application of these tools first person in, you know, fortunately, a lot of many provinces. And I think when it comes to the application of it, I think for a long time, it's always been about what could be possible. And I think the conversation is shifting towards what needs to happen in order to shift how we frame it into a return on investment conversation. And the reason for that is that when we tend to ask whether artificial intelligence can save money, I think the more honest question is whether it helps producers make better decisions before capital is committed. I think that's going to be the huge breakthrough for the sector and what we need. Because when we just look at, you know, the sector as itself, it contributes over $149 billion to GDP, and that's not a marginal gain. And it artificial intelligence can compound it over every acre. But the proof of profitability is not just productivity metrics. It's also looking at the labor shortages we see in the sector as well. I think a recent study by the Canadian Agricultural Human Resources Council, they have way too long of a name, but I love them. I think 28,000 unfilled positions signified a $3.5 billion economic loss. So ultimately, the conversation I'm having with producers, some who are using Claude to build their own apps, all the way to producers who are starting to tinker around with it, it's all about return on investment. It doesn't matter what this technology is unless it can bring that to them at the moment. And return on investment isn't just about profitability. It's also about, how do they manage their farms? And can we manage that data on-premise within Canada and keep our data sovereign as well? And not trying to take Donald's points away from him, but yeah.
Good setup, though.
I try my best.
And shout out Kark, shout out former Future Herd guest Jennifer Wright, the executive director of Kark. They are doing a great job.
Yeah.
I mean, build upon that, Donald. He clearly set you up. I mean, to what extent is that ROI self-evident?
Yeah, last week, maybe 2 weeks ago now, my team was on a roof in Eastern PEI installing a gateway and a Wi-Fi gateway and basically creating the mesh network to bring the real-time data into our AI platform that we need to mix with the meteorological and soil data to try and do what Mo's talking about. And simultaneous to that, I was at the House of Commons presenting to the Standing Committee on our agriculture compute strategy. It's become pretty clear to us pretty quickly that precision agriculture is becoming about what data needs to hit the main models and what data can be used inside the field boundaries in an inference model. And matching hardware to software and where we can use inference feels like the cutting edge this weekend. And agentic memory was sort of the cutting edge last weekend. And so that's kind of where we're at in the curve. And if we tried to move every single data piece around Prince Edward Island, around Canada, we will need about 200 gigawatt hours of electricity to run AI on Canadian farms. But if we allow the system to learn and decide for itself what data is required, we believe we can get that number down to about a gigawatt hour and a half. So significant, an order of magnitude less. And those are the types of decisions and the types of strategies that we need to be thinking about. It's difficult to find megawatt hours. We have to, distribute our compute need across the country. But to Mo's point, ensure that agricultural data is treated with the utmost security and sovereignty. And the most interesting thing about working on that bottleneck while my team was sort of filling in the blanks behind me was that the AI strategy came out that day at lunch, and last week the food security strategy came out, and the place where that overlaps is a tremendous space for research and development and implementation and productivity gain in Canada.
Well, and I definitely want to come back.
Please, go ahead, let's do it.
I want to jump in. Sorry, Jesse. Donald, I think the way we're positioning this discussion, I think, is really important, and I appreciate the efforts that you and your team are making. And I think when I look at the different federations of ags across the country, I think you have a really interesting strategy, and I'm really curious. When it comes to that national sovereignty in terms of, keeping data within Canada or even the modeling capabilities for our producers, how are you dealing with the OEMs, like the, the equipment manufacturers like Deere, Case New Holland? Are you speaking to them right now? Because they are some of the biggest providers of that data, but I don't know how much of that information is within Canadian soil. And also, when it comes to that utilization of data, how is it being used for our farmers? I'm just maybe really curious, just because I was at a conference last week speaking to other manufacturers, and that conversation was one of the, I guess it was a, I'm trying to find the right word. It was, it was something of like an elephant in the room that nobody really was addressing.
Certainly. One of the best perks of getting on this data governance train early a few years ago was being at the North American European Union conference in Como last summer in Italy, and I was
That's a nice perk.
It was great, and thank you to the Canadian Federation of Agriculture and the PEI Federation of Agriculture for making that happen for me. And so I got to present and had a lunch and learn, and I was grateful to be joined by the technology lead for the Italian Equipment Manufacturing Association. And he gave the room, myself included, a full briefing on the European regulations that compel these companies to provide true interoperability in their platforms. And so that's been tackling that through an industry association, the AEF, Agricultural Equipment Federation. And they're developing a software tool called AgIn. And they're ostensibly doing that in North America and Europe. Now, we've gone through the whole process to achieve API compatibility, basically receive the AgIn connector. We've done everything on our part and sent them the check. And we've sort of gotten, we're a little bit concerned now. It seems like, the wizard behind the curtain is, not necessarily what we thought it would be. And so it's an API integration that's necessary to do what we're trying to do. We believe the marketplace will allow that. It seems like those companies are adopting a strategy that allows them to be compliant to the European regulations in the North American market as well. Yeah, we believe that we're creating an option for farmers to work with those companies, but not be locked into their, proprietary data platforms, and that we will have interoperability in Canadian agriculture between equipment manufacturers, and that farmers will have a great deal of control over how that data is collected and used.
Well, and this is a good opportunity. Let me bring Mohsen into the conversation here, because this is a good opportunity to both tie in the research angle in terms of, I think, Mohsen, you're experiencing a different reaction from some of the researchers that you're sharing your research with and you're sharing your work from, to the extent that I think you're finding more and more enthusiasm for the opportunities these tools provide. But I'd love for you to also chime in on this data piece, because obviously part of the process of research is data collection and the kind of governance of the data collected. So I'd love, from the research perspective, for you to wade into this conversation before, Jen, we throw it to you.
Yeah, no, that's good. So basically, just I'm actually enjoying, what Mohammed and Donald talk about it. But in terms of my experience, I have a kind of like day-to-day experience with farmers, growers, industry partners, and researchers, and all of them have different ideas in terms of adapting new AI technologies. Like for farmers, they are usually suspicious about, is it like the AI technologies, is it going to be a good platform for decision-making, or how they can trust AI? Is it really good for them? And even if they are going to, like, if AI in the near future going to replace farmers or some of the jobs that they currently expert on it, like these kind of things are totally valid, to be honest. And I really appreciate what farmers are bringing to me. But the way that I'm usually addressing these kind of challenges is not by answering directly the question that they ask, but providing them necessary information. Like, who said AI is going to be a good decision making? Who said AI is going to replace your job? I recently developed an app that is not going to make a decision for you. It's going to help you to find relevant information quickly. That's it. It's your decision. Your act, your action, whatever you wanted to do it, do it. But if you wanted to find more information, instead of searching over the internet for an hour or 2 hours or even a day to find something interesting, you can use this app and find it in a second. That's it. So this is one of the, like, you know, one of the things that I'm usually addressing. And I believe trust is not building in one night. It's building gradually. And especially for farmers and growers, this is something that I wanted to focus on. And we've talked about, like, in the last time that we discussed, that I'm so happy that I was invited by farmers to talk about Bean GPT, like something totally related about AI, instead of talking about variety and some of the, like, you know, new varieties that we are releasing. Of course, I'm going to talk about them, like, in a couple of, like, meetings with them, but that I have in the future. But something that caught my eyes on that time was how farmers are enthusiastic to adopt these new technologies once they are certain that these are not going to interrupt their day-to-day activity. So this is something that I found it for the farmers. For researchers, they are still uncertain about, like, you know, how valid the results that they are getting from it, or how much they can replicate it, how much they can adapt it in the actual, like, research, or even, is it really good to use AI for the research or not, or how ethical is this, right? So I'm right now a part of the committee for AI strategy committee at the university, and I'm seeing this kind of concern, and again, all those concerns are valid. We need to come up with a good strategy how to adopt AI. And I don't want it to just totally and blindly advocate for the use of AI and say that AI is perfect for everything. No, it maybe is not, right? Let's adopt it, let's check it, and see if it's good, we can use it. If not, find a new way, right? So, and then last things I wanted to talk about is how much data we are able to share, and we should share in the AI basis. And this is something that in the conference that I had last week, I discussed with a couple of my colleagues, you know, in Europe, and they said we wanted to adopt these new technologies, but we are afraid to what extent we can share our data, to what extent we can share our information over the internet. And there are a couple of ways. Like, at the university, we have our own networking, our own domain that we can use to build, like, you know, these kind of AIs, and we can, like, you know, develop and train our AI models based on whatever data that we have and only share the results with everyone who wanted to use it. So there is no need that everyone has an access to the fundamental data set that we are having. We can build data, we can build, sorry, AI, open all the data that we have and share the final result with everyone so they can use these models, right? So this is one of the good strategies that we can do it. Another one is type of the data that we are sharing. Most of the data that we have currently and we are not using, and I call it dark, and I call this data as dark data, is those data that we are not paying attention to them. And we don't mind if we wanted to share them publicly or not. Like, let's say in my breeding program, I'm selecting I'm working with 200,000 individual plants, right? And I'm evaluating all of them. But at the end of the day, I'm selecting 7,000 of them and I'm cheering for one of them. But how about the rest? How about the rest of the data? What am I doing? I'm just saving them, storing them as an archive. I'm just archiving them. So, okay, if I wanted to build an AI or in like, you know, decision, if I wanted to include them in decision-making process, do I really mind about it? No, I don't mind it. I wanted to help on that case. So there, I'm sure that there are so many researchers like me, they wanted to share such this kind of information. But at some point, they need to have, like, we need to have a good discussion around it. We need to come up with a good strategy. And also we need to have a good transfer learning in terms of the knowledge that we have.
Get on.
Academia is funny. You guys are funny. Yeah. You guys are funny.
Keep it civil.
Anyway.
Jen.
Well, academia, there's a lot of caution. And I understand that, there's also a lot of fervor behind the scenes about trying to position Canadian agriculture and academic data management as part of the next policy framework in agriculture in Canada. And, caution is important. And that's sort of always been our thing, is that data governance is going to become the most important thing to profitability and business risk management. And here we are. And so, we've got 2 years to figure out the next policy framework. Nobody can come up with effective business risk management strategies. Both sides are unhappy with the current state. And, the key is in better data processing and analysis and the use of these new software tools to deliver that on a massive scale. And the great example is carbon credits. I mean, as long as I've been in Canadian agriculture for 5 years, I've been waiting for Environment and Climate Change Canada to release the protocol for making regulated soil carbon credits in Canada. They seem to be completely unable to, and our agentic AI system has developed a very clear pathway that not only satisfies VERA, but also keeps us from having to deal with the licensing of third-party models and are able to deal with the standards and parse them and deliver real data requirements to actually deliver environmental goods and services credits to the marketplace.
So if I could, I'm going to interrupt here, because the initial question that Jesse asked was, are we at risk of leaving some farmers behind? He said it much more eloquently when it comes to AI. And then we dove into an entire discussion about data and decision making. And what I find super curious is, when I talk to farmers about AI, they get nervous. If I talk to farmers about data and decision making, they know exactly what they need, what they're nervous about, and the kinds of data they need to make decisions. And so I'm wondering if we're just having parallel conversations, and it's just the words we're using that are making people nervous. And I'm curious to think if you think if we changed our dialogue or how we are defining some of the words, if we're not really leaving farmers behind when it comes to AI, and in fact, they could be further ahead than most people.
I just wanted to sorry for that. So this is Jen, this is exactly something that I'm really advocating for that. And I just wanted to make sure that farmers and growers are very well, understanding what's the use of AI, how they can use the AI for their betterment of their lives, not just replacing their job or even threatening any aspects of their lives. And this is something that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, that instead of telling them how AI can be a good decision maker, how AI can be a good automating something or that, we can tell them how AI can help them. Instead of just, as I said, instead of finding information for days, they can find an information in a second. Instead of just calling me every time or calling any of the persons every time, and maybe I'm not, I may not be available on that time, they can ask and AI and getting help, like, you know, from AI. These are the some of the things that they can use it. And once they are started to use AI in this way, they are getting adapted. And they are, I'm sure, and this is exactly the same thing that happened with the Ontario bean growers. They are very well, like, you know, I'm so happy and I'm so proud that I'm working with this community. They are very well, they are awesome, Ontario bean growers. So they adapted these new technologies and gradually, and right now they are advocating for AI. So this is something that we built based on not a very good trust at the beginning, but we started to use it and test it to see how it goes, right? And it goes perfectly right now. And we are both are in agreement that we should advocate for AI for the next, like, you know, future, whatever, like projects or subjects. So this is something that I'm trying to do it when it comes to the farmers and growers, not only for the decision and how I wanted to use the data or how I wanted to keep the data or managing the data, but also try to make AI simple and understandable and try to assure everyone that AI is here to be a good tool for all of you.
So I'll jump in. And Jen, I think to answer your question, I think the term artificial intelligence is a cliche. And the reason I say that is it's been mentioned so many times in so many capacities that it's lost its, like, real definition. And if I were to put a definition for artificial intelligence, I would say it is advanced statistical pattern recognition at scale. And there are multiple ways of achieving this through tools like large language models, through neural networks, through a plethora of different tools. So when it comes to the conversation of AI, because at a really high level, it's been talked about in really broad terms, it seems as if, you know, farmers have to walk through this new paradigm when they are trying to operationalize these tools on their farms. For the most part, in my opinion, they are using elements of artificial intelligence, albeit, okay, they're not maybe building their own neural networks and processing billions of images at a time, but they are using, again, introductory tools at the very least in order to evaluate different decisions. Now, whether artificial intelligence or the data they have on their farm will enable them to make real-time decisions, that's a journey every farmer is at a different stage on. So when it comes to using artificial intelligence at scale, it really depends on the tool that they have. And the thing I recommend to producers is don't buy something off the shelf if you think that you're going, because you think you're missing a gap on your farm. Use the strength that you have on your operations to fully utilize these tools. So for instance, if you as a producer, again, let's take Jesse for instance. Jesse is an operator and he has a really keen ability to maybe forecast yields. And he has a data set that helps him every year. Build on that expertise as opposed to introducing a new tool enter your operation. And I think that's the evolution a lot of producers are at a different stage at. And I think that's part of the conversation as to why AI is a bit convoluted these days, is because we just put any tool that we're seeing, you know, mentioned on the news into this bucket. And that's why it's become a bit of a cliche, and it's sometimes why some producers are a bit apprehensive to have that conversation. But when I talk to a lot of producers, even using your mobile device is a form of using AI if we're going to be nitty-gritty about those details.
Yeah, mobile devices are great edge computers. That's a big rallying statement in our shop these days, is that every farmer is already holding an edge computer. And you know, the exciting thing is agriculture has so much ground to make up, or sort of has missed kind of web 2.0 and a lot of cloud-based computing opportunities. And so they're managing $1 trillion worth of capital, and they're doing it with systems that haven't been fully modernized compared to other serious capital buckets and supply chains. And so if you boil it down to it, I still think that this moment is about, to Muhammad's point about advanced statistical probabilities and at scale, Canadian agriculture is a perfect example, and bringing the ability to collect, analyze, and manage data effectively and scale up our ability to learn from that full data set through a sovereign compute strategy that keeps, you know, effective gates. That's how we fix business risk management. It's business risk management is slow, backwards looking. It doesn't incentivize resilience. And in order to do those things with a national business risk management program for Canadian farmers, we have to use cutting edge technology to collect, manage, and analyze data and deliver insights both to the farmer and to the lenders and the insurers and the marketplace.
Well, and Donald, let me get you to go ahead. Well, I wanted, Donald, you evoked something really powerful earlier when you talked about, you know, the way in which your agents were outrunning Environment Canada's carbon credit system. To what extent is the agentic era accelerating everything we're talking about? Like, on the one hand, I think Mohammed, you know, quite correctly was pointing out the way in which a range, an ecosystem of technologies are being collapsed into a single phrase. But the agents now are a driving part of that ecosystem. It's a part you're playing with, I think, in a really interesting way. So take what you just described and throw agents into the mix. And how do we ground that back into the AI for all kind of rallying cry?
Well, the models, you know, these models... And I agree with Mohammed that artificial intelligence is cliche. I think that's very well put, and that it encompasses many different types of technology. But the these agentic approaches to utilizing the models is really about giving them managing context. So you're trying to create boundaries in which they're responsible for in an effort to manage their context window and produce results more efficiently. And that efficiency, you know, is why we need a sovereign compute strategy for agriculture. We need to conduct research and development on how to identify and move the data around and ensure that we can maximize the benefit of all agricultural data while operating within the bounds of good taste when it comes to data governance. So that agentic moment, we saw a very rapid movement between Claude Code and the agentic approach to utilizing those frontier large language models. We're now at a point where the frontier models already are becoming prohibitively expensive for the type of day-to-day modeling that we were using them for in February. And so we need, and not only that, but they're a huge risk to data governance and data sovereignty, and need to be utilized appropriately and effectively to manage cost and manage risk. And so now we're working with, to Mohammed's point, we match these frontier models with the research loops. And really what's happening now is trying to get these systems running fully air-gapped. You know, we've got this mocked-up air-gap system using a series of Mac Minis. And these days at the Federation, it's all about bare metal, you know, and getting the models on bare metal. And there's no question that there will be a hardware device designed that combines a Raspberry Pi and a Wi-Fi gateway with an agricultural inference model, and that will be sold to farmers in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years. That hardware software matching to facilitate the field boundary management of data is the whole. That's where LLMs are headed across the whole economy, and you know, this is as exciting a space for this technology as any in the Canadian economy.
So, Mohammed, I just wanted to ask you another question. So would you please, again, define what is artificial intelligence? What did you say? sorry for what how did you define it?
Yeah, the definition I've been using just as an approachable standard is it is advanced statistical pattern recognition at scale.
Okay.
Leveraging different tools like large language models or neural networks in order to uncover insights, forecast, or detect patterns within data sets not discernible to the naked eye. Again, so, Wilson, I'm just riffing here.
So you mentioned advanced statistical approach, but my question is, do you think simple regression, linear regression model is a part of AI or not?
You know what's funny, Mohsen? The Ontario Securities Financial Institution, whatever it's called, OSFI, would consider that AI.
It's not only Ontario, it's the science.
AI, that's the thing.
One of the aspects, one of the subjects of the AI is machine learning. And on the machine learning, we have supervised learning. And on the supervised learning, we have the regression models. And on the regression, we have the simple linear regression. So AI is not only pattern recognition, and AI is not like classification. We have so many areas in AI. When we are talking about AI, it's exactly look like that you talk about agriculture. But what's inside agriculture is plant breeding, plant physiology, genetics, you know, all those areas. I to be honest, I cannot say AI is the advanced statistical approach. I can refer to what is AI is based on the IBM that provided as artificial intelligence, the technology that enable computers and machines to simulate human learning, comprehension, problem solving, decision making, creativity, and autonomy. This is something that I can refer what is AI. But when it comes to the advanced, I'm against of that. I don't think that, you know, AI is the all about advance. It's all about, and AI, this is something AI established in 1915.
I don't want to split hairs on like a definition. I think my intention with the term advanced is it's not as simple. It's not binary, right? It's more of like you're using sophisticated ways to get to, let's say, an insight, for instance.
But let me.
That's and it's like the language I'm using isn't less
codifying language and conducting modeling and being able to. I don't think it's particularly elegant, but you know, neither are power lines. You know, so.
But
the best, but breaking language into code the same way we broke genetics into code and we have economics, you know, analysis is certainly, so, you know, an advanced piece of technology. There's no question about it. Like it completely changes one of the main three languages, like the three codes that humans use to create the socius.
Let me bring this back. Hold on. You know, Mohsen, I think, made a really important point, which is, if we think of AI as a spectrum rather than a binary, then that spectrum on both sides goes much farther than a lot of people really entertain or are aware of. And one thing I really want to bring the conversation back to, because Donald evoked this a couple of times, you know, while really fleshing out why sovereignty is such a crucial part of this larger conversation. I know that the vast majority of people do not understand what's involved in training a model, right? They hear about these models, they hear about mythos, they hear about fable, they hear about, you know, a deep seek, all these new models out there. But we do have two people here on the call, maybe three, who have actually trained and built models. So break that down again, not just for Jen's benefit, but I think for a lot of people's benefit. When we start to imagine a sovereignty, a Canadian AI ecosystem that runs in Canada, trains in Canada, infers in Canada, how difficult or easy it is to train and build models. Mohsen, I'll go to you first, but then Mohammed, obviously, I want you to jump in when you see fit.
That's a great question, Jess. The point is, It totally depends on the use of the AI models and after, like, you know, in what area, in what, like, you know, aspects do you want it to use AI models, and then I can tell you how difficult it is for training the models. I'm thinking as a person who wanted to do the research, and I can't give you a very immediate answer. But to be honest, as long as we have a broad spectrum of the data that cover all the instances that we are facing and we have faced before, I think that would be a good a database for training the models. Let's say if I wanted to make a decision about like plant breedings, I'm trying to move toward the digital twin and developing digital twins for plant breeding instead of just wasting so much of energy and plants in the field. I can just simulate it, what will happen in terms of the future climate change scenarios. So in this case, what I fed my models was the 50 years of the databases that all was grown in different areas, locations in North America. And I collected all this information and trained, and it still is not enough. Because I can't predict what will happen in the future, really. It's so hard to predict, right? But this is one instance. Another instance is I wanted to use AI to predict the pattern on the maturity of the pattern of my dry beans, right? So the maturity pattern are usually consistent. So if I have a couple of years data and I can include it to the training the models, that would be enough. So the question is, where and how you wanted to use this model, and then training is based on training the amount of the data that you need to train is based on where you wanted to use this AI model.
So Jesse, can you repeat your question more of a time? I just want to make sure that I'm going to cover all the parts of it.
Well, what's involved in building a model? I think when people hear the phrase AI sovereignty or Canada needs to control its AI infrastructure, they don't totally understand the pieces. And obviously the model, to Mohsen's point, specifically the focus or the capabilities of the model is important. So again, from a big picture, from a leadership perspective, what's involved in training a model? And is that the kind of capacity we can and should be developing across the sector?
Totally. Okay, so I'm going to cheat a bit, and I'm going to take it further than that. But again, to my two colleagues on the call, include where you think I'm messing up, but essentially I'm going to keep it simple. But essentially, I think the first thing when it comes to model development, and this is for you, Jen, I mean, like the way I think about it is like, let's define the question. What are we building the model to predict or decide? Mm-hmm. And that's where we would start things off from. For instance, like when we're thinking about agriculture in particular, can we build a model to predict if the yield will drop below a threshold, for instance, based on a lot of different elements? That's maybe the question we want to answer. After you have that refined question, again, to the best of your ability, and again, that question can also change. This is a dynamic process. You would gather that data. And I think when people say data is the new oil, like that's the point that I think this is all about. It's because when it comes to looking at forecasting or trying to uncover insights, the more data you have, historical or in terms of, let's say, when you're looking at yields, do you have weather data? Do you have market information? Do you have information about activities and the impact of those activities, like a farm activity, like cover crops, or let's say no-till, for instance, how is that going to impact the model ultimately so that you can answer that initial question you have? And then, of course, once you have that foundation of data, and it can come from different platforms. And the reason why, and just to go a little sidebar for a second, the conversation about that ecosystem play, where all three of us, all five of us on this call can share information freely amongst each other, which is what we call an API. It's basically a digital handshake, for lack of a better term. If we're able to share that information amongst us all, that actually enables us to answer the question more accurately, in my opinion. It, of course, takes a lot of training. Yeah. It's not easy. It's going to take time as well. But once you have an ecosystem where you can share that data, you're actually able to get more information that you can incorporate within your model as well. And then once you decide on the appropriate data set, once you clean that data as well, because Jen, I can't emphasize enough how many times I've seen glyphosate spelt in I've seen it maybe spelt in 100 different ways. Like I've seen it with the U once. So you have to go through that process and maybe make sure that the data itself is clean. Then, like, I guess like the last two steps is then you have to test it, and then you have to measure the confidence you have in the results you get from that information. And once you test it, then you can deploy and monitor it as well. Just to, again, when you deploy it, you're never going to have it 100% effective from the get-go. You have to improve on it. Now, the part that I want to cheat a bit about is the concern I have within the industry these days. And what we're seeing is, and not in a Canadian context, I think agriculture, for the most part, has been forward-looking when it comes to sharing data. And all five of us on this call are building protocols to enable ourselves to share that information. And I think that is amazing. The trend I'm starting to see, and this is coming from the equipment manufacturers, again, like tractors and whatnot, they're starting to charge their users money in order to not only collect that data, but then even to share that data. And the way I would put it in an analogy is, it's like you're going to a pizza parlor, you're paying for the pizza, and then you're getting charged to share those slices to your friends. And that's not really building an ecosystem then. And that's the big concern I have. So when it comes to that foundational model building, that's the way one were to do it, and the way we're able to maybe cultivate that ecosystem so that we can share better and more pivotal information amongst one another. So Jesse, I try to keep that short.
No, that was fantastic. And Donald, it really allows me to bring you in as someone who I know is following news in the AI world, although I suspect all present are. And with the removal of the Mythos class models of Fable and larger one that was made available, there's a lot of people talking about open source. There's a lot of people talking about sovereignty. To your earlier point, the price of accessing the frontier models continues to go up. Is there a critical mass now, not just of collaboration, as I think Mohammed was inferring, but of active data sharing, of creating an ecosystem of models that are more accessible, more affordable, or am I just dreaming here? I'm curious if you could connect some of these dots for us, especially grounded in the work that you're actively doing.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great panel with an NGO rep and an industry rep and an academic rep, and all those sectors along with government have to work together to build more sustainable systems, whether it's the food system or another complex system. Mm-hmm. And that's what we'll find here. I personally think the whole Mythos rollout is marketing, you know, up to and including this, which is impressive and sort of aligns with this kind of massive economic growth strategy around, you know, picks and shovels and what you can do with them. So yeah, Gold Rush is tough to manage, and you never know who's working with who to make sure that this thing continues to drive new records in the stock market. But there's no question that our future in agricultural data means at the farmer level. And Motion has said a few times about how fast agriculture is and the different implications for data in agriculture. And so I do want to just say that, you know, from the grassroots at the farm field level, some data will leave the farm. The field. Some data will leave the field only if it empowers the rest of the model, if it empowers the model to grow more stronger. For the most part, decisions will be inferred at the field boundary based on lightweight models that can be housed in edge computing. And I suspect, again, that there'll be hardware development around that for farmers. But we will not be moving all of the data off farm. We'll move hashes to the blockchain, and we may move the data into the cloud if that's what the farmer wants and they're willing to pay for that. But the effort to collect and manage and analyze and build decision-making capacity for farmers at the farm field level. We cannot move all of the data out of the field. It doesn't make sense for data security, and it doesn't make sense for a practical, efficient use of large language modeling and building decision-making capacity. Artificial intelligence, we can outsource intelligence, but we can't outsource understanding. And so we will deliver intelligence to the farmers in a way that they can utilize, and then they will interpret it and implement it on their land.
And do you want to just take a moment to unpack edge computing? Because again, I think it's one of those phrases that those of us in the know understand. But you've made a really good argument today as to why it is an essential element of any agricultural AI strategy.
Yeah. We need $150 million to do a few years of research and development here. And, somewhere in around 75 or 80 million of that has to be in equipping our farmers with edge computing. And it should have been part of OFCAF. It should have been part of the last policy framework. But we have to build an intelligence layer right on top of the field. And in order to do that, we need edge computing, which would be any form of compute that's found sort of in the three-dimensional world, like in the space and time as we understand it. So that edge can be sensors, it can be cameras, it can be GPS. That's life on the edge. It's your connectivity to the real world. As much as we want to use our 50-year biogeochemical model, and as much as we want to use our climate modeling to help build decision making, to everyone's point today, we need to mix that with what's happening on the farm right now, with those outlier events, and make sure that the models are ground truth effectively, constantly being updated as the climate changes, and that they are equipped to not just deal with the status quo or the average, but with what's actually happening on farm. And that happens through the edge layer.
Right on. And we are just about out of time. So we'll take a moment to do kind of forward looking or speculative thoughts on where this is heading. And, Mohsen, I'm gonna throw to you first, only because I just read about alluding to Bean GPT expanding beyond beans and expanding into other research areas. So perhaps use that as a way to talk about where you see the kind of near term in terms of this stuff evolving.
Yeah, that's great. So so before I talk about what would be next after Bean GPT, I just wanted to say, I totally agree with Donald and Mohammed, what they said, what they've mentioned about data management and also how to get this data, because I think AI has been here for more than 7 years, but the major problem right now that we are facing is how we can obtain the data and how we can share, to what extent we are able to share the data, and to what extent we can ask farmers to produce this and collect this amount of data and make it accessible to us for developing different models. But anyway, so in terms of the Bean GPT, I initially, we initially created Bean GPT specifically for beans, but right now, after I had this good discussion after the presentation that I had last week in International Legume Conference, I found a very great interest on the use of Bean GPT, and they said they wanted to I received a good interest in terms of advancing Bean GPT beyond beans, on the lentil, on other legumes, and also on other crops, definitely possible to extend it to other crops. So we wanted to do it. And also another feature that we wanted to add it is the pattern recognition. Definitely wanted to add it to the Bean GPT as the Bean Vision, that everyone can just take the picture of the raw seeds bean, uncooked seeds bean, and then post it on the Bean GPT, and the Bean GPT can tell them that what would the quality. But this is all about the Bean GPT, but the future of AI, I think, is going to be more on quantitative AI. So I think, you know, I think it's going to be more on, it's going to be more on the quantum approach. And in the next couple of years, I think we are going to shift toward the quantum approaches. And I'm seeing that a couple of interests around that they are starting to adopt it, the quantum approach. And again, quantum approach is not something new. It will be new, like in the couple of years, everyone will talk about the quantum approach. But I think, you know, the future of AI belongs to quantum approaches. Yeah.
Mohammed.
I'll let Donald go.
Okay,
sure.
Donald.
Yeah, and the Bitcoin owners are definitely focused on a quantum approach for sure. And farmers will be interested to see quantum is, you know, it's a huge part of if this thing is going to get somewhere. But anyway, yeah, that's very interesting. I think that, you know, I haven't made any big secret about where I think we're headed, I guess, in the near term. Like we need a tiered sovereign architecture. We need the edge layer to be a secure public gateway back and forth from the field. We need the compute layer that has that frontier AI capability for when we need advanced reasoning and AI-assisted automation and decision support, high-performance retrieval, operation scalability. And then the key is the Sentinel layer, that sovereign data control, that Sentinel node that sort of is the traffic cop that allows us to unlock the full benefits of the edge and the compute layers. That third piece helps us use frontier cloud AI, but also ensures fully sovereign local AI for those sensitive or regulated workloads. I think, you know, mixing all those together and ensuring that we're focused on sharpening our pencils when it comes to how much compute we need and therefore how much electricity we need, because there's no question there's a bottleneck in electricity. And so being as efficient as possible will help us execute on our sovereign compute requirements.
Then I'll go. I guess I want to make you richer, Jesse. That's where I want to get to in the next 5 years. And if we can use artificial intelligence to get you there, like the different tools, that's the way I want to do it. And I think, you know, I think, again, the tools that are encapsulated within artificial intelligence will move away from a tool that's an individual from individual operations to adopt that are adopted in isolation, actually, to the connective layer that connects equipment, agronomy, lending, and markets into a single intelligent system. And it's through the use of agents as well. We didn't get into too much of that today, but maybe we can assemble all the Avengers again and talk more AI soon.
Yes, absolutely. If in no small part because of the rapid rate of change that I think has been one of the undercurrents to our conversation today. And that is where I think the original challenge that Jen paraphrased of making sure that no farmer is left behind is going to be an ongoing process. And that's where your respective leadership is indispensable. Jen, any final thoughts or comments from you before we conclude?
Yeah, so many. I have a lot more questions, so I would love to assemble the Avengers once more. You guys have taught me a lot. I have some deep thinking to do, but right. I will be back in touch for sure.
Right. Yeah.
That's a good
thank
sign.
You very much.
Good.
And again, thank you. We will have to, on Mohammed's call, reassemble some point soon. I will work, have my scheduling agents talk to your scheduling agents. And we will be able to work something out. Thanks again, everybody.
Thank you, Jesse. Thanks
you,
everyone.
Brian.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Future Herd Assemble. What a fantastic session that, quite frankly, exceeded the already ambitious expectations I had when gathering together the kind of bright minds that we did. Now, granted, this is the kind of episode that we could have gone on for another hour, maybe even two. I really do try to limit these episodes, both for my own biological needs, but also so that we can allow these conversations to cultivate with time, to, like fine wine, continue to ferment and allow that knowledge to multiply. Because there were a lot of threads that came up today, in particular Donald kind of evoking how language is really at the core of the current revolution in AI, and it's our ability to use our vocabulary, in particular an agricultural vocabulary, a business vocabulary, a natural vocabulary, biological, chemical. All of this suggests that we're entering into a world where it's not just about talent, it's about collaboration amongst the talented. And granted, the agricultural sector has always valued collaboration, but one of the very subtle through lines of today's conversation that Donald, to his credit, kept emphasizing is the value of cross-sectoral collaboration. What happens when you get a researcher and a banker and an association rep in a room with a hacker and you start having conversations about what is possible, what we should focus on, what is important, what is the source of curiosity when it comes to not just surviving but thriving in the technological revolution we find ourselves in. I'm already starting to schedule these three wise guys into another session where we will go even further, because the AI revolution waits for nobody. And the question is not whether we need to conform to the marketing and hype of the hyperscalers. Quite the opposite. We can and will bend the technology to our needs, our culture, our values. And that's where Mohammed, Mohsen, and Donald are really exemplary of the kind of leadership we have here in Canada and how that can be applied to technology to make the technology work for us. So thanks to them, thanks to Jen, thanks to you for listening, for watching, and for sharing this with your friends who are wondering why AI should be taken seriously, why we can be both critical of it, but also bending it to meet the desires and dreams that we as a society, as a culture, hold. So thanks again. We'll see you soon here on The Future Herd.